Tonight's edition of Ideas and Issues was recorded on location in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, professor of philosophy at East Tennessee State University, and I'll be hosting tonight's program. My guest this evening is Tom Beecham of the Kennedy Institute of Ethics, and we're going to be discussing physician-assisted suicide. Glad to have you with us, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Could you begin by telling us a little bit about the Kennedy Institute of Ethics?
The Kennedy Institute is a research institute in ethics. It was founded in 1971, opened its doors in 1971, primarily to deal with ethical issues in biomedicine, emerging ethical issues in biomedicine. At that time, there was only one other institute, and it had just started in the country, or any component part of a university that was dealing with such issues, so we were in there at a very early stage. Over the years, the institute has expanded beyond more than biomedicine. For example, a couple of our members here teach business ethics in the business school, but are members of the institute. So it is, in effect, a research institute where people in the university gather to pool their ideas about ethics and have symposia, and we have outside speakers and the like, and it is very interdisciplinary in character.
Well, in light of that, since one of the main issues is biomedical ethics, our topic tonight is physician-assisted suicide, and I'm sure most of our listeners have heard about Dr. Kevorkian and his attempts to assist some terminally ill people to bring about a speedy death. Before we begin to talk about physician-assisted suicide, though, let's begin with a topic that, though controversial, is perhaps a bit less controversial. Sometimes patients may choose not to pursue some kind of medical treatment, some treatment that's thought to be life-saving or life-prolonging, for example, refuse chemotherapy if they have cancer, certain forms of cancer, or refuse treatment if they have some kind of degenerative disease. Other times they may actually ask to be removed from some kind of life-saving equipment. I'm wondering, do you think these decisions are ever justified, and if so, why?
Do I think that the refusal is justified, or a lack of recognition of the refusal is ever justified?
Well, let's begin by the refusal.
The refusal. I think not only is the refusal justified, I think the refusal is always justified if you're talking about a competent patient.
Okay.
There are no circumstances under which a refusal by a competent patient would not be justified. There might be a rare exception where you would be justified in overriding a quite justified refusal, but those cases would be extremely rare.
Okay, you use the term competent patient. Could you explain what you mean by competent and why you see that as so important?
Right. Well, you've got basically two kinds of competence. There's psychological competence. They have the capacity to do whatever task it is. In this case, it's a decision-making task. And there's also legal competence. That is to say, they've been adjudicated by a court to be able to handle their own affairs rather than somebody else handling their affairs for them. Now, those can cross over. You could have somebody who's been adjudicated legally competent but was, in fact, psychologically incompetent. Basically, when I use that term, I would hope that we're talking about somebody who is both legally competent and someone who is psychologically competent, so that we don't have to constantly be making those distinctions. So that's basically okay. What I'm presupposing is that they're both. I'm just saying that sometimes you can have somebody who's one or the other, and sometimes, of course, in many cases, you have people who are neither. An obvious case of neither would be an infant.
All right. Well, now, some listeners might be bothered by this idea that a competent person can choose, in effect, to end their own life, certainly to not take actions which prolong their life. Could you say a little bit about why you think it would be okay for them to refuse treatment under those circumstances?
Well, I would think what people would be bothered by would be a circumstance in which they saw that as being either a suicide or tantamount to a suicide. And then we get into questions about whether suicide is justified or not. But the lower-level kind of question, the basic one that you're raising, I think, are the kind of cases where you have a refusal of treatment and then somebody dies, but it's not normally considered anyway a suicide. For example, you've got somebody who is a dialysis patient. They're on kidney dialysis, and their kidney is failing, and the doctor comes and says, there is really nothing else we can do for you. The dialysis might prolong your life for another 3 weeks or so, but frankly, you're going to be in agony. Do you want me to dialyze you or not? And you say, no, I refuse the dialysis, which perhaps the person had been on for several years. I'm going to stop dialysis at this point. I don't think very many people would have trouble with that. And of course, your standard refusal of treatment cases are like that. It's a calculated judgment as to whether or not that therapy is worth it or not, which a competent person is obviously capable of doing. Now, you may have some cases where a doctor has recommended something and somebody refuses it for irrational reasons, even though they're competent persons. You might say, well, that's a contradiction. How can you have somebody who refuses irrationally when they're competent? Well, somebody can be legally competent and psychologically competent to make decisions, but make a terrible mistake or freeze or whatever on a particular occasion. And so if you had something like that arise, then you might have reservations about the refusal, because you might say a refusal has really got to be an informed refusal. Under those particular circumstances, it was not an informed refusal, and therefore it would be bad to recognize that refusal. So you could have rare cases like that, but in the standard case of the competent person refusing, very, very few people nowadays or courts have any problem with saying that's not only a right, it's an absolutely protected right.
Okay, so the question, though, about the irrational choice would be the situation under which you might say the person could refuse, but perhaps a doctor would also be justified in refusing to honor the refusal. Would that be correct or not?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
All right, well, let's shift the grounds a little bit into the actual topic of tonight. Historically, at least, a number of commentators have thought that there was a difference between a patient's decision to refuse treatment and a doctor's actually helping the patient speed their death, for example, by giving them an overdose of morphine or some such way. What's the rationale for that? I mean, I'm not asking you what you think, but just what's the rationale that most people have used historically for wanting to distinguish between passive euthanasia, what's been called passive euthanasia, and active euthanasia?
Well, passive euthanasia is, in the vernacular that's been used lately more than any other, is a case of allowing someone to die. We could prolong your life, but we're not going to, under the circumstances, prolong your life. We're going to allow you to die. Now, that might be at the person's request, so it would be voluntary passive euthanasia. Or you might have someone who's not competent, or otherwise it's not at their request, in which case it would be involuntary passive euthanasia. So it's allowing them to die where the understanding is it's allowing them to die from conditions that pre-exist. You don't put these conditions there. They have a pre-existing injury or illness or system failure or something of that sort, and that's what's going to be doing the causing of the death. So it's passive on your part to allow that to occur by either not intervening with a machine or withdrawing a machine or some other medical technology.
Okay. Now, why understanding that, though, why have people been so bothered by the idea of a physician helping to actually speed a person's death, say in the case of Dr. Kevorkian?
Well, it gets back to this causal question that I just alluded to. If the physician intervenes, and rather than a condition of disease or injury causing the death, it's the physician who causes the death, then it's generally been categorized, whether rightly or wrongly, it's been categorized as a case of killing rather than a case of allowing to die. Killing then is associated with active euthanasia. So just as you want to avoid killing everywhere, it's a prima facie reason or rule, moral rule against killing, but not against allowing to die, that then becomes the critical difference. In other words, you might say the critical difference in this area between active and passive is the difference between killing and allowing to die. Now, that's obviously not true generally. killing doesn't mean the same thing as active, nor does allowing to die mean the same thing as passive. But that's the critical difference as it's understood here.
I take it, though, that you are not entirely comfortable with that, with distinction being used in that way to justify refusing or not allowing physicians to assist their patients in suicide.
Yes, I'm very uncomfortable with these distinctions. By and large, I believe these distinctions do not serve us well in medicine. They may serve us well in some other context. I won't try to generalize, but I don't think they serve us well in medicine, and I don't think they've served us well in law insofar as law ranges into medical contexts.
Okay. Let's pause briefly for the benefit of any listeners who may have just tuned in. I'm Hugh LaFollette, and my guest on Ideas and Issues is Tom Beacham for the Kennedy Institute of Ethics. What I'd like to do, Tom, is to let you explain a little bit more about why you think that distinction does not serve us as well, at least in the context of this debate.
Yeah, well, the problem has been the following. Doctors and lawyers, many doctors and many lawyers, and many people in ethics as well, I think it's pretty clearly been the dominant view, have said if a doctor actively does something or other, then he or she kills. And if they passively do something or other, then they merely allow to die. So the constraints on what you can do, as it were, the boundaries around what you can do, are drawn around the territory of allowing to die. Now, here's the problem. What is it to allow someone to die? Well, the very idea of allowing suggests that you do something. You withhold something, you withdraw something, or something of that sort. But you have to do something, in many cases, you have to do something in order that they die. Now, right away, it doesn't take much imagination at all to see that you've moved from the language of omission and letting things happen to doing something so that something will happen. And what a lot of people have picked up on, again, lawyers, doctors, other observers, is that, well, maybe in the doing of something, you're actually not just letting them die, you're killing them. In other words, you begin to get to have a very fuzzy distinction between allowing to die and kill. So suddenly you've moved from saying, well, the doctor allowed this person to die in the very same range of cases to saying that the doctor killed the person. A classic case of the so-called baby doe type cases, where one group wants to say, when you let an infant die of some condition, but you do so in a fashion that might be considered negligent, you actually should have attended to them, in that case, you didn't do something that you should have done, since you didn't do it intentionally, it was an action on your part, and you killed them. So these categories then begin to get mixed together. Whereas my view is, we'd be better off by not using these categories at all. I don't think it helps at all in these discussions to say it's either a case of allowing to die or killing. My view is, wipe the categories out completely, draw the slate clean, start over again and trying to figure out what it is that doctors and patients are doing in this circumstance that might be justified or unjustified without trying to invoke these categories.
Well, how would you describe it then? If we're not going to talk about these problems in terms of categories and killing and letting die, what would you suggest the appropriate way of describing the relationship and the interaction as being?
Let's go back to your earlier question. I don't know whether you set up the show in this way or not, but I'm going to go back to your earlier question about refusals.
Okay. Right?
You have a circumstance in which a doctor goes to a patient and says, I recommend so-and-so. And the patient says, I don't want it. And the doctor says, without it, you will die. The patient says, I don't care, I don't want it. What is that? Is that killing or letting die? Well, I don't know about you, I'd be very reluctant to try to start sticking labels like that on. I would say what you have in this circumstance is a classic case of, assuming it's a competent patient, a justified refusal. It does not matter what the doctor thinks in this case, where the doctor thinks that this person made a very bad mistake in not taking the therapy. It's a justified refusal. the refusal justifies the doctor in not administering the therapy. In fact, I would say it so strongly, the doctor would be immoral to administer the therapy under that circumstance. So you don't have a case of allowing to die. You don't have a case of killing. What you have in this circumstance is a justified refusal on the part of the patient. And any time you have a justified refusal, even if it is a case of allowing to die, in the way in which we were describing that just a moment ago, it would be perfectly justified. So far I haven't had to say anything at all about either killing or allowing to die to convince most people, I think, that what happened in this circumstance, by both the patient's action of refusal and the doctor's action of recognizing refusal, was perfectly appropriate.
Okay.
But that's just a starter. That's not everything, but that's just
all right.
A starter.
But what you mean by justified here is not that the doctor agrees with the decision.
Not at all.
But that the doctor makes the judgment that the person is competent, even if they disagree with it. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
Now, once I take it then, once you say that the justified refusals are legitimate, that you want to say it's either a small step or no step at all to justified requests.
That's the next question. Now, a lot of people think there's a big gulf here. We're talking about a circumstance in which somebody's going to die.
Right.
That's the context that we're in. So we've just been talking about a justified refusal in which your life will end by virtue of that. And almost everybody thinks nowadays that you have the right to do that, and the doctor does no wrong in recognizing your right to do so. That's not the case when you go to requests. Because
right.
Now you're requesting, it's a certain kind of request. It's a request for the doctor to help you die.
Right.
Not just to not administer something, but to actually help you die, either by writing a prescription for pills, injecting you with an overdose, or otherwise making some move, taking some action that's a clear causal contribution to the outcome of your dying, and you request help from the doctor in that regard. Now, that is illegal in every state in the United States, with the possible exception of Oregon, where a court is considering whether or not it can be legal there.
Okay. Now, what you're wanting to say, though, is that from a moral standpoint, if a person is about to die anyway, that you're not clear about that there should be any moral distinction between a justified refusal and a justified request. Is that correct?
I'm saying in the minds of a great many people, there's a very sharp boundary to be drawn here. So far, we're still not talking the language of killing or letting die.
No.
Right? We're still in this business about justified refusals or justified requests. And in the minds of many people, there's a very sharp difference to be drawn between a justified refusal and a justified request. And they then many of them want to go on and push that distinction into the allowing to die killing territory, because what they want to say is something like the following. A justified refusal, so recognized by a doctor, is an allowing to die. And it's fine. It's perfectly fine. It's always perfectly fine, precisely because it is a justified refusal. So the whole weight of the moral circumstance is not really placed on the doctor's shoulder. The doctor doesn't make this decision about allowing the person to die. The person makes the decision, and that's what does the justifying. Then they say, now let's switch over not to a refusal, but to request. So a person goes to a doctor and says, I request your help. Now, the view here is that's not justified on the part of the doctor to help, and that's exactly what we mean by killing. So whereas you're justified in allowing a refusal, you're not justified in participating by meeting a request. And that's the difference between allowing to die and killing. My view is we ought not to draw that line either. That what we should say is it depends, whether it's justified or not, depends very much, in the case of, say, refusal of treatment, on the condition of the patient as to whether it's justified or not. And similarly, we'd have to go over, in the case of a request, and see whether or not the request was justified. But in any event, we ought not to bring categories like killing and letting die into the picture. We ought to focus on whether or not either the refusal or the request is justified. Now, you might say, wait a minute, but you in effect said, if it's by a competent person, a refusal is always justified. Even that picture is a little bit murkier when you get into third parties, for example, parents who decide for children. Suppose a parent refuses for a child, it's not the child who refuses, but a parent who refuses for the child, then we can raise a question about whether or not that refusal was justified. It may very well be justified, in which case the logic goes through in the same way. You would allow the child to die by virtue of a justified refusal.
Okay, so the whole emphasis, as far as you're concerned, should be shifted from talking about killing and letting die to talking about justified refusals or requests, and that
that's right,
and that at least with normal adults, the emphasis is on the competence of that adult. And to some extent, then it seems to me that you're wanting to rely upon the notion of autonomy, that individuals ought to have some say over how they live their life and how they die.
That plays a critical role here in the process of the justification. But the important thing to get us where we are now, and the important thing to observe, is we've gotten here without any mention whatsoever of killing and allowing to die, and we can go on from this point without any mention whatsoever of killing and allowing to die, because that distinction need not play any role now in our justification. As you say, we can go on to talk about autonomy, rights of autonomy and the like, without any mention of killing and letting die. So what I'm trying to say, I'm trying to prove my point or make the point again, that we don't need these distinctions between killing and letting die, and that we've been driven by the wrong engine. Because basically what we've done in the past is we've said, is it a case of killing or letting die? If it's a case of allowing to die, it's okay. If it's a case of killing, then it's not okay. What I'm suggesting is, of course, we not allow that to drive us at all, that we throw it away and be driven completely by accounts of what's justified or unjustified.
And to that extent, it seems to me you'd also be unhappy with the label physician-assisted suicide, or would you?
Well, suicide, of course, suggests killing. Yes, I'd be much happier if we could use a different language. That is, of course, the language
right.
that we've adopted, but I do consider it a somewhat prejudicial language.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, despite the fact that you think that sometimes people can be justified in requesting physicians for assistance to speed their death.
Yeah.
We're not going to call it killing now, but just try to talk about neutrally as requests for assistance to speed their death. You nonetheless have some misgivings about legalizing the practice.
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain some of those misgivings?
Well, the arguments that have long been used, not the only arguments, but ones that have long been used, are so-called slippery slope arguments or wedge arguments. The idea is that if you change your practices, your rules, and the like, there are bound to be changes that occur in a social context from a change of those practices and rules. One of the changes that people have often pointed to is the possibility of abuses. For example, if you legalize a circumstance in which a person's demise might be brought about with the assistance of another, then there could be, there are unscrupulous families that would be very happy to get rid of a certain family member, particularly if it's a very, very expensive hospitalization. And they would either convince a doctor of something that's not right or would be in collusion with a doctor or whatever. And so many people would prematurely be brought to the end. Or perhaps the family would pressure the person to themselves make a decision because now it's legal. What was once illegal is now legal. So all of those things are, I think, of real concern. They place us on a slippery slope of changing our views and inviting abuses and the like. But the one that I take myself most seriously of all is in the training and responsibilities of physicians, because we've always trained doctors to be healers, and death was the enemy and all that sort of thing. And there's been in the past a great deal of commitment on the part of doctors to that point of view. If you now begin to tinker with what a doctor's responsibilities are, and you take, for example, the new law in Oregon, it really looks like a doctor has a responsibility unless there's some reason that the doctor himself or herself doesn't want to play this game. You have a responsibility if a patient comes to you several times and ask for a prescription so that they can kill themselves, you're now in the obligation to do so. So you may fundamentally change in the training of the physician their understanding of their relationship to a patient. I think that we've already seen some of this, not in the area of killing and letting die, but some changes in modern medicine that put the doctor further away from the patient and lessen their sense of responsibility for the patient. And that's what I worry about.
So there's basically there's a tension between what might be justified in an individual case. I'm dying. I only have a short time to live. I'm in great pain. You're my doctor.
Would you help me?
Would you help me? And you're wanting to say that I'm justified in making that choice, and as my primary caregiver, you should help me out. But at the same time, you're reluctant to allow that to occur legally because of the changes that you envision that might happen.
That's right.
Training of physicians.
That's right.
Well, how do we get out of this dilemma then? I mean, here we have an individual practice that seems to make sense, an individual action on a one-to-one relationship that seems to make sense, and yet the practice or the institution of allowing physician-assisted suicide is potentially dangerous. Is there any way to escape this problem?
I don't know that there is any way to escape it, but I'll give you a couple of ideas about it. One is to say we simply ought to go on as we now understand the system and as practices basically occur in the system now. Meaning by that, every once in a while a case of this sort comes to light in the public, and a physician is brought before a grand jury. A grand jury almost never indicts the physician. Now, you have to ask yourself, why not? Because in many of these cases, there was a clear, crystal clear violation of the law, but the grand jury refuses to indict. Why is it? Because the grand jury recognizes, once they see the facts of the case, that that doctor really did nothing wrong. I don't mean legally wrong. Legally, it was wrong. I mean, morally wrong. They recognize the doctor had a good relationship with the patient, was really doing everything that he or she could do to help the patient, and they don't indict. So you might say, basically, we have a system at the present time that pushes the doctor not to perform such actions except under very rare circumstances in which it's justified and could be justified before a grand jury. All right? So you might say, one thing we could do is just leave the system as we have it at the present time with these tensions in it. The second thing we might do is basically to say, well, we support the law in Oregon, or some version of the law in Oregon, but we only support that law within those limited boundaries. We don't want national legislation on it. We only want to take a look, maybe for several years, at what happens in Oregon to see whether or not the predictions of very dire consequences or very good benefits, in fact, turn out dominantly to be true. In other words, Oregon would become for you a social experiment. Now, either of those seem to me realistic possibilities. Which one would I prefer to see? Well, somewhat surprisingly, perhaps, given my earlier position, I would prefer to see something like a very well-written law in Oregon, where that becomes kind of testing ground for these laws.
I've been talking this evening with Tom Beecham from the Kennedy Institute of Ethics about physician-assisted suicide. Glad you joined us, Tom.
Thank you.
Listeners have enjoyed the program. This has been Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good evening.